Side 4. The Difference Engine by William Gibson and Bruce Sterling. Continuing on page 116. Mallory ducked through a tall, unmarked door and down a hall flanked by locked storerooms. At the hall's end, a single magisterial voice was audible through the closed door of the curator's office. Mallory knocked, then listened, smiling, as the voice completed a particularly orotund rhetorical period. "Enter!" rang the voice of the curator. Mallory stepped inside as Thomas Henry Huxley rose to greet him. They shook hands. Huxley had been dictating to his secretary, a bespectacled young man with the look of an ambitious graduate student. "That will be all for now, Harris," Huxley said. "Send in Mr. Reeks, please, with his sketches of the Brontosaurus." The secretary tucked his penciled notes into a leather folio and left, with a bow to Mallory. "How have you been, Ned?" Huxley looked Mallory up and down with the narrow-set, pitilessly observant eyes that had discovered Huxley's lair in the root of the human hair. "You look very well indeed. One might even say splendid." "Had a bit of luck," Mallory said gruffly. To Mallory's surprise, he saw a small, fair-haired boy, neatly dressed in a flat-collared suit and knee-breeches, emerge from behind Huxley's heaped desk. "And who is this?" Mallory said. "Futurity," Huxley quipped, bending to pick up the child. "My son, Noel, come to help his father today. Say, how do you do to Dr. Mallory, son?"
"How do you do, Mr. Mallory?" the boy piped.
"Dr. Mallory," Huxley corrected gently. Noel's eyes widened.
"Are you a medical doctor, Mr. Mallory?"
The thought clearly alarmed him. "Why, you could scarcely walk when last we met, Master Noel," Mallory boomed heartily. "And here you are today, quite the little gentleman." He knew that Huxley doted on the child. "How's your baby brother, then?" "He has a sister now as well," Huxley announced, setting the boy down. "Since you were in Wyoming. You must be happy at that, Master Noel." The little boy smiled briefly with guarded politeness. He hopped up into his father's chair. Mallory set his valise atop a bookcase, which contained a Morocco-bound set of the works of Cuvier in the original. "I have an item that may interest you, Thomas," he said, opening his valise. "A gift for you from the Cheyenne." Remembering to tuck the French letters beneath the Westminster Review, he brought out a string-tied paper bundle and carried it to Huxley. "I hope this isn't one of those ethnographical curios," Huxley said, smiling, as he parted the string neatly with a paper knife. "I can't abide those wretched beads and whatnot." The paper held 6 shriveled brown wafers, the size of half crowns. "A helpful bequest to you from a Cheyenne medicine man, Thomas." "Rather like our Anglican bishops, are they?" Huxley smiled, holding one of the leathery objects to the light. "Dried vegetable matter. A cactus?"
"I would think so. Joseph Hooker of Kew could tell us. This witch doctor chap had a fair grasp of the purpose of our expedition. He fancied that we meant to revivify the dead monster here in England. He said that these wafers would enable you to journey far, Thomas, and fetch back the creature's soul."
"And what do I do, Ned? String them on a rosary?"
"No, Thomas, you eat them.
You eat them, chant, beat drums, and dance like a dervish until you fall down in a fit. That's the standard methodology, I take it." Mallory chuckled.
"Certain vegetable toxins have the quality of producing visions," Huxley remarked, putting the wafers carefully away in a desk drawer.
"Thank you, Ned. I'll see they're properly catalogued later. I fear the pressure of business has confounded our Mr. Reeks. He is usually more prompt."
"It's a good crowd out there today," Mallory offered, to fill the silence. Huxley's boy had pulled a toffee from his pocket and was unwrapping it with surgical precision.
"Yes," Huxley said. "Britain's museums. Our fortresses of intellect, as the PM puts it in his eloquent way. Still, no use denying that education, mass education, is the single great work at hand. Though there are days when I would throw it all over, Ned, to be a field man like yourself again."
"You're needed here, Thomas."
"So
So they tell me, Huxley said. I do try to get out once a year, Wales mostly, tramp the hills. It restores the soul. He paused. Did you know I am up for a lordship?
No, Mallory cried, delighted. Tom Huxley, a lord. Struth, what splendid news.
Huxley looked unexpectedly morose. I saw Lord Forbes at the Royal Society.
Well, Forbes said, I am glad to tell you that you are all right for the House of Lords. The selection was made on Friday night, and I hear that you were one of those selected.
Huxley, without apparent effort, had Forbes' gestures, his phrasing, even his tone of voice. He glanced up. I haven't seen the list, but the authority of Forbes is such that I feel somewhat assured.
Of course, Mallory exulted. A stout fellow, Forbes.
I shan't feel entirely certain until I receive official confirmation, Huxley said. I confess, Ned, to some anxiety about it, the health of the Prime Minister being what it is.
Yes, a pity he's ill, Mallory said. But why should that concern you so? Your accomplishments speak for themselves.
Huxley shook his head. The timing seems no accident. I suspect this is some ploy of Babbage and his elite cronies, a last attempt to pack the Lords with scientific savants while Byron still holds sway.
That's a dark suspicion, Mallory said. You were evolution's greatest advocate in debate. Why question your good fortune? It seems to me a matter of simple justice.
Huxley grasped his own lapels, two-handed, a gesture of deep sincerity. Whether I have the lordship or not, I can say one thing. I have left my case to stand on its own strength. I have never asked for special favor. If the title is mine, it is not through any intrigue of my own.
Intrigue does not enter into it, Mallory said.
Of course it does, Huxley snapped, though you'll not hear me say it publicly. He lowered his voice. But you and I have known each other many years now. I count you as an ally, Ned, and a friend of truth.
Huxley began to pace the Turkish carpet before his desk. It is no use our having any false modesty about a matter so important. We have certain vital duties to perform, to ourselves, to the outside world, and to science. We swallow praise, which is no great pleasure, and endure multitudinous difficulties, involving a good deal of unquestionable pain and even danger.
Mallory was unsettled, taken aback both by the speed of the news and the sudden weight of Huxley's sincerity. Yet Huxley had always been like this, he thought. Even as a young student, there had been a shock and an impetus to the man's company. For the first time since Canada, Mallory felt himself back in his true world, in the cleaner, higher plane that Huxley's mind inhabited.
Danger of what kind? He asked belatedly.
Moral danger. Physical danger as well. There is always hazard in the struggle for worldly power. A lordship is a political post. Party and government, Ned. Money and law. Temptation. Perhaps ignoble compromise. The nation's resources are finite. Competition is sharp. The niche of science and education must be defended. Nay, expanded.
Huxley smiled grimly.
Somehow we must grasp the nettle. The alternative would be to lie still and let the devil have his way with the world to come. And I, for one, should rather burst to pieces than see science prostituted.
Startled by Huxley's bluntness, Mallory glanced at the little boy, who was sucking his toffee and kicking his bright shiny shoes against the chair legs.
You are the man for the task, Thomas, Mallory said. You know that you may have whatever help I can offer, if the cause ever needs me.
It cheers me to hear that, Ned. I do trust in your strength of heart, your stubborn fixity of purpose. Proved true as steel, 2 years' hard labor in the Wyoming wilderness. Why, there are men I see every week who claim great devotion to science, yet dream of nothing but gold medals and professors' caps.
Huxley was pacing faster. An abominable blur of cant, of humbug and self-seeking, surrounds everything in England today.
Huxley stopped dead.
That is to say, Ned, that I sometimes suppose that I myself am tainted, the possibility of which I hold in morbid dread.
Never, Mallory assured him.
It's good to have you back among us, Huxley said, resuming his pacing. And famous, better yet. We must capitalize on that advantage. You must write a travel book, a thorough account of your exploits.
Odd that you should mention that, Mallory said. I have just such a book here in my bag, The Mission to China and Japan by Lawrence Oliphant. A very clever chap, it seems.
Oliphant of the Geographical? Man's a hopeless case, too clever by half, and lies like a politician. No, I propose a popular rendition, something a mechanic can understand. The sort of chap who furnishes his sitting room with a Pembroke table and a crockery shepherd and shepherdess. I tell you, Ned, that it's vital to the great work. Good money in it as well.
Mallory was taken aback. I talk well enough when I've a head of steam up, but to write a whole book in cold blood...
We'll find you a Grub Street hack to varnish the rougher bits, Huxley said. A common enough stratagem, believe me. This fellow Disraeli, whose father founded Disraeli's Quarterly, you know, bit of a madcap, writes sensation novels, trash, but he's steady enough when he's sober.
Benjamin Disraeli? My sister Agatha dotes on his romances.
Something in Huxley's nod was meant to tell Mallory that a female of the Huxley clan would not be caught dead with a popular novel. We must talk about your Royal Society symposium, Ned. Your forthcoming address on the Brontosaurus. It will be quite the event, a very useful public podium. Do you have a good picture for publicity?
Why, no, Mallory said.
Maul and Polyblank are your men, then, daguerreotypists to the gentry.
I'll make a note of that.
Huxley crossed to the mahogany-framed blackboard behind his desk, taking up a sterling chalk holder. Maul and Polyblank, he wrote in quick, flowing cursive. He turned. You'll need a kinotropist as well, and I've just the fellow. He does a good deal of Royal Society work, tends to somewhat excessively fancy work, so he'll steal your show with his clacking, given half a chance, loading every rift with ore, as he puts it. But he's a clever little chap.
John Keats, he wrote.
This is invaluable, Thomas.
Huxley paused.
There's another matter, Ned. I hesitate to mention it.
What is that?
I don't wish to wound your personal feelings.
Mallory smiled falsely.
I do know I'm not much of a speaker, but I have held my own in the past.
Huxley paused, then lifted his hand abruptly.
What do you call this?
I call it a piece of chalk, Mallory said, humoring him.
Chalk?
Chalk, Mallory repeated.
We must do something about those broad Sussex vowels, Ned. There's a fellow I know, an elocutionist. Very discreet little man. French, actually, but he speaks the finest English you've ever heard. A week's lessons with him would do wonders.
Mallory scowled.
You're not saying I need wonders, I should hope.
Not at all. It's a simple matter of educating one's ear. You'd be surprised to know how many rising public speakers have patronized this gentleman.
Jules d'Alembert, Huxley wrote. His lessons are a bit dear, but...
Mallory took the name down. A knock came at the door. Huxley swiped at the board with the dusty felt of an ebony-handled eraser.
Enter!
A stocky man in a plaster-spotted apron appeared.
You'll remember Mr. Trenham Reeks, our assistant curator.
Reeks tucked a tall folio binder under his arm and shook Mallory's hand. Reeks had lost some hair and put on weight since Mallory had last seen him.
Sorry for the delay, sir, Reeks said. We're having a time of it in the studio, casting those vertebrae. Astonishing structure. The sheer scale presents terrific problems.
Huxley cleared a space on his desk. Noel tugged his father's sleeve and whispered something.
Oh, very well, Huxley said. Pardon us a moment, gentlemen.
He led Noel from the office.
Congratulations on your promotion, Mr. Reeks, Mallory said.
Thank you, sir, Reeks said. He opened the binder, then set a ribboned pince-nez on his nose.
and thank you for this great discovery, though I must say it challenges the very scale of our institution." He tapped at a sheet of graft foolscap. "As you may see." Mallory studied the sketch, a floor plan of the museum's central hall, with the skeleton of the Leviathan superimposed. "Where's its skull?" he said. "The neck extends completely into the entrance hall," Reeks said proudly. "We shall have to move several cabinets. Do you have a side view?" Reeks plucked it from the sheaf of sketches. Mallory examined it, scowling. "What is your authority for this anatomical arrangement?" "There are very few published papers on the creature to date," Reeks said, hurt. "The longest and most thorough is by Dr. Fulk, in last month's Transactions." He offered the magazine from within the folder. Mallory brushed it aside. "Fulk has completely distorted the nature of the specimen." Reeks blinked. "Dr. Fulk's reputation..." "Fulk is a uniformitarian. He was Rudwick's cabinet man, one of his closest allies. Fulk's paper is a tissue of absurdities. He claims that the beast was cold-blooded and semi-aquatic, that it ate soft water plants and moved sluggishly. But a creature of this vast size, Dr. Mallory, this enormous weight, it would seem that a life in water, to support the mass alone..." "I see," Mallory broke in. He struggled to regain his temper. It was no use annoying poor Reeks. The man was a functionary, who knew no better and meant well. "This explains why you have its neck stretched out limply, almost at floor level. And it also accounts for the lizard-like, no, the amphibian, jointing of its legs." "Yes, sir," Reeks said. "One envisions it harvesting water plants with that long neck, you see, seldom needing to move its great body very far or very swiftly, except perhaps to wade away from predators if there were anything hungry enough to tackle such a monster." "Mr. Reeks, this creature was not some great soft-bodied salamander. You have been made the victim of a grave misconception. This creature was like a modern elephant, like a giraffe, but on a far greater scale. It was evolved to rip out and devour the tops of trees." Mallory took a pencil from the desk and began to sketch rapidly and expertly. "It spent much of its time on its hind legs, propped on its tail, with its head far above the ground. Make a note of this thickening in the caudal vertebrae, a sure sign of enormous pressure from a bipedal stance." He tapped the blueprint and went on. "A herd of these creatures could have demolished an entire forest in short order. They migrated, Mr. Reeks, as elephants do, over vast distances, and quickly, changing the very landscape with their devastating appetites. The brontosaur had an erect, narrow-chested stance, its legs quite columnar and vertical, for the swift, stiff-kneed stride of an elephant. None of this frog-like business." "I modeled the stance on the crocodile," Reeks protested. "The Cambridge Institute of Engine Analytics has completed my stress analysis," Mallory said. He stepped to his valise, pulled out a bound sheaf of fan-fold paper, and slapped it down. "The creature could not have stood a moment on dry land, with its legs in that absurd position." "Yes, sir," Reeks said quietly. "That accounts for the aquatic hypothesis." "Look at its toes," Mallory said. "They're thick as foundation stones, not the webbed feet of a swimmer. And look at the flanges of its spinal vertebrae. This creature levered itself up at the hip joint to reach great heights, like a construction crane." Reeks removed his pince-nez. He began to polish it with a linen kerchief from his trouser pocket. "This is not going to please Dr. Fulk," he said, "or his colleagues either, I dare say." "I've not yet begun with that lot," Mallory said. Huxley re-entered the office, leading his son by the hand. He looked from Reeks to Mallory. "Oh dear," he said. "Already deep into it, I see." "It's this nonsense of folks," Mallory said. "He seems determined to prove that dinosaurs were unfit to live. He's portrayed my Leviathan as a buoyed slug sucking up pond weed." "You must agree it hadn't much of a brain," Huxley said. It doesn't follow, Thomas, that it was torpid. Everyone admits that Rudwick's dinosaur could fly. These creatures were swift and active. Actually, now that Rudwick's no longer with us, there's some revisionary thought on that topic, Huxley said. Some say his flying reptile could only glide. Mallory bit back a curse for the sake of the child in the room. Well, it all comes back to basic theory, doesn't it, he said. The uniformitarian faction wish these creatures to seem dull and sluggish. Dinosaurs will then fit their slope of gradual development, a slow progression to the present day. Whereas, if you grant the role of catastrophe, you admit a far greater state of Darwinian fitness for these magnificent creatures, wounding as that may seem to the vanities of tiny modern-day mammals on the order of Polk and his cronies. Huxley sat down. He propped one hand against his whiskered cheek. You disagree with the arrangement of the specimen?
It seems Dr. Mallory prefers it standing, Reeks said, prepared to dine upon a treetop.
Could we manage that position, Mr. Reeks? Reeks looked startled. He tucked his pince-nez in a pocket behind his apron. Then he scratched his head.
I think perhaps we might, sir. If we mounted it under the skylight and braced it from the ceiling girders, might have to bend its neck a bit. We could aim its head at the audience. It would be quite dramatic.
A sop to the Cerberus of popularity, Huxley said, though I question the consequences to the fluttered nerves of paleontology. I confess I'm not at all at ease with this argument. I've not yet read Folk's paper, and you, Mallory, have yet to publish on the topic. And I shouldn't care to add to the heat of the catastrophist debate, Natura non facit saltum.
But nature does leap, Mallory said.
The engine simulations prove it. Complex systems can make sudden transformations. Never mind the theory. What can you make of the evidence directly at hand?
I can make a good case. I will at my public lecture. Not a perfect case, but better than the opposition's.
Would you stake your reputation as a scholar on it? Have you considered every question, every objection?
I could be wrong, Mallory said, but not so entirely wrong as they are.
Huxley tapped his desk with a reservoir pen.
What if I ask, as an elementary matter, how this creature could have eaten woody foliage? Its head is scarcely larger than a horse's, and its teeth are remarkably poor.
It didn't chew with its teeth, Mallory said. It had a gizzard, lined with grinding stones. Judging by the size of the rib cage, this organ must have been a yard long and weighed perhaps 100 pounds. 100 weight of gizzard has more muscular power than the jaws of 4 bull elephants.
Why would a reptile need that quantity of nourishment?
It wasn't warm-blooded per se, but it had a high metabolism. It's a simple matter of surface-to-volume ratios. A bodily mass of that size retains its heat even in cold weather.
Mallory smiled. The equations are simply calculated, requiring no more than an hour on one of the Society's smaller engines.
Dire trouble will come of this, Huxley murmured. Are we to let politics stand in the way of truth?
Touché.
He has us, Mr. Reeks. I'm afraid you must alter your painstaking plans.
The lads in the studio love a challenge, sir, Reeks said loyally. And if I may say so, Dr. Huxley, a controversy does wonders for our attendance.
One more minor matter, Mallory said quickly. The condition of the skull. Alas, the specimen's skull is quite fragmentary and will require close study and a certain amount of conjecture. I should like to join you in the studio on the matter of the skull, Mr. Reeks.
Certainly, sir. I'll see that you're given a key.
Lord Gideon Mantell taught me everything I knew about the modeling of plaster, Mallory declared with a show of nostalgia. It's been too long since I last came to grips with that worthy craft. It will be a great pleasure to observe the latest advances in technique in such exemplary surroundings.
Huxley smiled with a hint of dubiousness. I do hope we can satisfy you, Ned.
Mopping the back of his neck with a kerchief, Mallory unhappily contemplated the headquarters of the Central Statistics Bureau.
Ancient Egypt had been dead for 25 centuries, but Mallory had come to know it well enough to dislike it. The French excavation of the Suez Canal had been an heroic business, so that all things Egyptian had become the Parisian mode. The rage had seized Britain as well, leaving the nation awash with scarab neckpins, hawk-winged teapots, lurid stereographs of toppled obelisks, and faux marble miniatures of the noseless Sphinx. Manufacturers had engine-embroidered that whole beast-headed rabble of pagan godlets on curtains and carpets and carriage robes, much to Mallory's distaste, and he had come to take an especial dislike to silly maunderings about the pyramids, ruins which inspired exactly the sort of chuckle-headed wonderment that most revolted his sensibilities. He had, of course, read admiringly of the engineering feats of Suez. Lacking coal, the French had fueled their giant excavators with bitumen-soaked mummies, stacked like cordwood and sold by the ton. Still, he resented the space usurped by Egyptology in the geographical journals. The Central Statistics Bureau, vaguely pyramidal in form and excessively Egyptianate in its ornamental detail, squatted solidly in the governmental heart of Westminster, its uppermost stories slanting to a limestone apex. For the sake of increased space, the building's lower section was swollen out of true, like some great stone turnip. Its walls, pierced by towering smokestacks, supported a scattered forest of spinning ventilators, their vanes annoyingly hawk-winged. The whole vast pile was riddled top to bottom with thick black telegraph lines, as though individual streams of the Empire's information had bored through solid stone. A dense growth of wiring swooped down, from conduits and brackets, to telegraph poles crowded thick as the rigging in a busy harbor. Mallory crossed the hot, sticky tarmac of Horse Ferry Road, wary of the droppings of the pigeons clustered in the webwork of cable overhead. The Bureau's fortress doors, framed by lotus-topped columns and Briticized bronze sphinxes, loomed some 20 feet in height. Smaller workaday doors were set into their corners. Mallory, scowling, strode into cool dimness and the faint but pervasive odors of lye and linseed oil. The simmering London stew was behind him now, but the damned place had no windows. Egyptianate jets lit the darkness, their flames breezily guttering in fan-shaped reflectors of polished tin. He showed his citizen card at the visitor's desk. The clerk, or perhaps he was some sort of policeman, for he wore a newfangled bureau uniform with an oddly military look, made careful note of Mallory's destination. He took an engine-printed floor plan of the building from beneath his counter and marked out Mallory's twisting route in red ink. Mallory, still smarting from the morning's meeting with the nominations committee of the Geographical, thanked the man rather too brusquely. Somehow, he didn't know which devious strings had been pulled backstage, but the plot was clear enough. Folk had maneuvered his way onto the Geographical's nominations committee. Folk, whose aquatic theory of Brontosaurus had been spurned by Huxley's museum, had taken Mallory's arborivore hypothesis as a personal attack, with the result that an ordinarily pleasant formality had become yet another public trial for radical catastrophism. Mallory had won his fellowship in the end, Oliphant having laid the ground too well for Folk's last-minute ambush to succeed, but the business still rankled. He sensed damage to his reputation. Dr. Edward Mallory, Leviathan Mallory, as the penny papers insisted on having it, had been made to seem fanatical, even petty, and this in front of dignified geographers of the first rank, men like Burton of Mecca and Eliot of the Congo. Mallory followed his map, muttering to himself. The fortunes of scholarly warfare, Mallory thought, had never seemed to favor him as they did Thomas Huxley. Huxley's feuds with the powers that be had only distinguished him as a wizard of debate, while Mallory was reduced to trudging this gaslit mausoleum, where he hoped to identify a despicable racetrack pimp. Taking his first turn, he discovered a marble bas-relief depicting the mosaic plague of frogs, which he had always numbered among his favorite biblical tales. Pausing in admiration, he was very nearly run down by a steel pushcart, stacked to the gunwales with decks of punch cards. "Gangway!" yelped the carter in brass-buttoned serge and a messenger's billed cap.
Mallory saw with astonishment that the man wore wheeled boots, stout lace-ups fitted with miniature axles and spokeless rounds of rubber. The fellow shot headlong down the hall, expertly steering the heavy cart, and vanished around a corner. Mallory passed a hall, blocked off with striped sawhorses, where two apparent lunatics, in gas-lit gloom, crept slowly about on all fours. Mallory stared. The creepers were plump, middle-aged women, dressed throat to foot in spotless white, their hair confined by snug elastic turbans. From a distance, their clothing had the eerie look of winding sheets. As he watched, one of the pair lurched heavily to her feet and began to tenderly wipe the ceiling with a sponge mop on a telescoping pole. They were charwomen. Following his map to a lift, he was ushered in by a uniformed attendant and carried to another level. The air here was dry and static, the corridors busier. There were more of the odd-looking policemen, admixed with serious-looking gentlemen of the capital, barristers, perhaps, or attorneys, or the legislative agents of great capitalists, men whose business it was to acquire and retail knowledge of the attitudes and influence of the public. Political men, in short, who dealt entirely in the intangible. And though they presumably had their wives, their children, their brownstone homes, here they struck Mallory as vaguely ghost-like or ecclesiastical. Some yards on, Mallory was forced to abruptly dodge a second wheeled messenger. He caught himself against a decorative cast-iron column. The metal scorched his hands. Despite its lavish ornamentation, lotus blossoms, the column was a smokestack. He could hear it emitting the muffled roar and mutter of a badly adjusted flue. Consulting his map again, he entered a corridor lined left and right with offices. White-coated clerks ducked from door to door, dodging young messenger boys rolling about with card-laden wheelbarrows. The gas lights were brighter here, but they fluttered in a steady draft of wind. Mallory glanced over his shoulder. At the end of the hall stood a giant steel-framed ventilator fan. It squealed faintly on an oiled chain drive, propelled by an unseen motor in the bowels of the pyramid. Mallory began to feel rather dazed. Likely this had all been a grave mistake. Surely there were better ways to pursue the mystery of Derby Day than hunting pimps with some bureaucratic crony of Oliphant's. The very air of the place oppressed him, scorched and soapy and lifeless, the floors and walls polished and gleaming. He'd never before seen a place so utterly free of common dirt. These halls reminded him of something, another labyrinthine journey. Lord Darwin. Mallory and the great savant had been walking the leaf-shadowed hedgy lanes of Kent, Darwin poking at the moist black soil with his walking stick. Darwin talking on and on, in his endless, methodical, crushingly detailed way, of earthworms. Earthworms, always invisibly busy underfoot, so that even great sarsen stones slowly sank into the loam. Darwin had measured the process, at Stonehenge, in an attempt to date the ancient monument. Mallory tugged hard at his beard, his map forgotten in his hand. A vision came to him of earthworms churning in catastrophic frenzy, till the soil roiled and bubbled like a witch's brew. In years, mere months, perhaps, all the monuments of slower eons would sink, shipwrecked, to primeval bedrock.
"Sir, may I be of service?"
Mallory came to himself with a start. A white-coated clerk was confronting him, staring into his face with bespectacled suspicion. Mallory glared back, confused. For a divine moment he had poised on the brink of revelation. And now it was gone, as miserably inglorious as a failed sneeze. Worse yet, Mallory now realized he had been muttering aloud again, about earthworms, presumably. Gruffly, he proffered his map. "Looking for level 5, QC-50.
"That would be quantitative criminology, sir. This is deterrence research."
The clerk pointed at a shingle hung above a nearby office door. Mallory nodded numbly.
"QC is just past nonlinear analysis, around the corner to your right," the clerk said.
Mallory moved on. He could feel the clerk's skeptical eyes on his back. The QC section was a honeycomb of tiny partitions, the neck-high walls riddled with asbestos-lined cubbyholes. Gloved and aproned clerks sat neatly at their slanted desks, examining and manipulating punch cards with a variety of specialized clackers' devices. Shufflers, pin mounts, isinglass color coders, jewelers' loops, oiled tissues, and delicate rubber-tipped forceps. Mallory watched the familiar work with a happy lurch of reassurance. QC-50 was the office of the Bureau's Undersecretary for Quantitative Criminology, whose name, Oliphant had said, was Wakefield. Mr. Wakefield possessed no desk, or rather his desk had encompassed and devoured the entirety of his office, and Wakefield worked from within it. Writing tables sprang from wall slots on an ingenious system of hinges, then vanished again into an arcane system of specialized cabinetry. There were newspaper racks, letter clamps, vast embedded card files, catalogs, code books, clackers' guides, an elaborate multi-dialed clock, three telegraph dials whose gilded needles ticked out the alphabet, and printers busily punching tape. Wakefield himself was a pallid Scot with sandy, receding hair. His glance, if not positively evasive, was extremely mobile. A pronounced overbite dented his lower lip. He struck Mallory as very young for a man of his position, perhaps only 40. No doubt, like most accomplished clackers, Wakefield had grown up with the engine trade. Babbage's very first engine, now an honored relic, was still less than 30 years old, but the swift progression of enginery had swept a whole generation in its wake, like some mighty locomotive of the mine. Mallory introduced himself. "I regret my tardiness, sir," Mallory said. "I found myself a bit lost in your halls." This was no news to Wakefield. "May I offer you tea? We have a very fine sponge cake." Mallory shook his head, then opened his cigar case with a flourish. "Smoke?" Wakefield went pale. "No, no thank you. A fire hazard, strictly against regulations." Mallory put his case away, chagrined. "I see. But I don't see any real harm in a fine cigar, do you?" "Ashes," Wakefield said firmly. "And pneumatic particles. They float through air, soil the cog oil, defile the gearing. And to clean the Bureau's engines, well, I needn't tell you that's a Sisyphean task, Dr. Mallory." "Surely," Mallory mumbled. He tried to change the subject. "As you must know, I am a paleontologist, but I have some small expertise in clacking. How many gear yards do you spin here?" "Yards? We measure our gearage in miles here, Dr. Mallory." "'Struth? That much power?" "That much trouble, you might as easily say," Wakefield said with a modest flick of his white-gloved hand. "Heat builds up from spinning friction, which expands the brass, which nicks the cog teeth. Damp weather curdles the gear oil, and in dry weather, a spinning engine can even create a small Leyden charge, which attracts all manner of dirt. Gears gum and jam, punch cards adhere in the loaders." Wakefield sighed. "We found it pays well to take every precaution in cleanliness, heat, and humidity. Even our tea cake is baked specially for the Bureau, to reduce the risk of crumbs." Something about the phrase, "the risk of crumbs," struck Mallory as comic, but Wakefield had such a sober look that it was clear no jest was intended. "Have you tried Colgate's vinegar cleanser?" Mallory asked. "They swear by it at Cambridge." "Ah, yes," Wakefield drawled. "The dear old Institute of Engine Analytics. I wish we had the leisurely pace of the academics. They pamper their brass at Cambridge, but here in public service we must run and rerun the most grueling routines till we warp the decimal levers." Mallory, having been recently to the Institute, was up to date and determined to show it. "Have you heard of the new Cambridge compilers? They distribute gear wear much more evenly." Wakefield ignored him. "For Parliament and the police, the Bureau is simply a resource, you see. Always on demand, but kept on a tight lead for all of that. Funding, you see. They cannot fathom our requirements, sir. The old sad story, as I'm sure you know. Man of science yourself. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but the House of Commons can't tell true clacking from a wind-up cooking jack." Mallory tugged his beard. "It does seem a pity. Miles of gearing.
When I imagine what might be accomplished with that, the prospect is breathtaking.
Oh, I'm sure you'd catch your breath soon enough, Dr. Mallory, Wakefield said. In clacking, demand always expands to overmatch the capacity. It's as if it were a law of nature.
Perhaps it is a law, Mallory said, in some realm of nature we've yet to comprehend. Wakefield smiled politely and shot a glance at his clock. A shame when one's higher aspirations are overwhelmed by daily practicalities. I don't often have the chance to discuss engine philosophy, except with my soi-disant colleague, Mr. Oliphant, of course. Has he perhaps told you of his visionary schemes for our engines?
Only quite briefly, Mallory said. It seemed to me his plans for, social studies would demand more engine power than we have in Great Britain, to monitor every transaction in Piccadilly and so forth. Struck me as a utopian fancy, frankly.
In theory, sir, Wakefield responded, it is entirely possible. We naturally keep a brotherly eye on the telegram traffic, credit records and such. The human element is our only true bottleneck, you see, for only a trained analyst can turn raw engine data into workable knowledge, and the ambitious scale of that effort, when compared with the modest scale of the Bureau's current funding for personnel.
I'm sure I wouldn't care to add to the pressing burden of your duty, Mallory broke in, but Mr. Oliphant did indicate that you might help me to identify a criminal at large and his female accomplice. Having completed two of your request forms in triplicate, I dispatched them in by special messenger.
Last week, yes, Wakefield nodded, and we've done our best for you. We're always happy to oblige gentlemen as peculiarly distinguished as Mr. Oliphant and yourself. An assault and a threat of death against a prominent savant is a serious matter, of course.
Wakefield plucked up a needle-sharp pencil and a gridded pad of paper.
But a rather commonplace business to attract Mr. Oliphant's specialized interests, isn't it?
Mallory said nothing.
Wakefield looked grave.
You needn't fear to speak frankly, sir. This isn't the first time that Mr. Oliphant or his superiors have called on our resources. And, of course, as a sworn officer of the Crown, I can guarantee you the strictest confidentiality. Nothing you say will leave these walls.
He leaned forward.
So, what can you tell me, sir?
Mallory thought hard and quickly.
Whatever blunder Lady Ada had committed, whatever act of desperation or recklessness had led her into the clutches of the tout and his whore, he could not imagine it helped by the name Ada Byron going onto that gridded pad. And Oliphant, of course, would not approve. So Mallory feigned a reluctant confession.
You have me at a disadvantage, Mr. Wakefield, for I don't believe there's much to the matter. Nothing to truly earn me the privilege of your attention. As I said in my note to you, I encountered a drunken gambler at the Derby, and the rascal made a bit of a show with a knife. I thought little enough of it, but Mr. Oliphant suggested that I might be in genuine danger. He reminded me that one of my colleagues was murdered recently, in odd circumstances, and the case is still unresolved.
Professor Fenwick, the dinosaur savant.
Rudwick, Mallory said. You know the case. Stabbed to death, in a ratting den.
Wakefield tapped his teeth with the pencil's rubber.
Made all the papers, threw quite a bad light on the savantry. One feels that Rudwick rather let the side down.
Mallory nodded.
My sentiments exactly. But Mr. Oliphant seemed to feel that the incidents might be connected.
Gamblers stalking and killing savants, Wakefield said.
I see no motive, frankly. Unless, perhaps, and do forgive the suggestion, a large gambling debt is involved.
Were you and Rudwick close friends, wagering companions, perhaps?
Not at all. I scarcely knew the man. And I owe no such debts, I assure you.
Mr. Oliphant does not believe in accident, Wakefield said. He seemed to have been convinced by Mallory's evasion, for he was clearly losing interest.
Of course, it is only prudent of you to identify the rascal. If that's all you need of us, I'm sure we can be of service. I'll have a staffer take you to the library and the engines. Once we've this assailant's number, we'll be on firmer ground.
Wakefield flipped up a hinged rubber stopper and shouted into a speaking tube.
A young Cockney clerk appeared in gloves and apron. "This is our Mr. Tobias," Wakefield said. "He's at your disposal." The interview was over. Wakefield's eyes were already glazing with the press of other business. He gave a mechanical bow. "Pleasure to have met you, sir. Please let me know if we can be of any further service." "You're most kind," Mallory said. The boy had shaven an inch of scalp at his hairline, elevating his forehead for a modishly intellectual look. But time had passed since the clerk's last barbering, for he now had a prickly ridge of stubble across the front of his noggin. Mallory followed him out of the maze of cubicles into a hallway, noting his odd rolling gait. The clerk's shoe heels were worn so badly that the nails showed, and his cheap cotton stockings had bagged at the ankles. "Where are we going, Mr. Tobias?"
"Engine, sir, downstairs."
They paused at the lift, where an ingenious indicator showed that it was on another floor. Mallory reached into his trouser pocket, past the jackknife and the keys. He pulled out a golden guinea. "Here."
"What's this, then?" Tobias asked, taking it.
"It is what we call a tip, my boy," Mallory said with forced joviality.
"To ensure promptness, you know."
Tobias examined the coin as if he had never seen the profile of Albert before. He gave Mallory a sharp and sullen look from behind his spectacles. The lift's door opened. Tobias hid the coin in his apron. He and Mallory stepped aboard amid a small crowd, and the attendant ratcheted the cage down into the bureau's bowels. Mallory followed Tobias out of the lift, past a rack of pneumatic mail chutes, and through a pair of swinging doors, their edges lined with thick felt. They were alone again. Tobias stopped short. "You should know better than to offer gratuities to a public servant."
"You look as if you could use it," Mallory said.
10 days' wage?
"Expect I could, providing I find you right and fly."
"I mean no harm," Mallory said mildly. "This place is strange territory. In such circumstances, I've found it wise to have a native guide."
"What's wrong with the boss, then?"
"I was hoping you'd tell me that, Mr. Tobias." More than the coin, the remark itself seemed to win Tobias over. He shrugged. "Wakey's not so bad. If I were him, I wouldn't act any different. But he ran your number today, Governor, and pulled a stack on you 9 inches high. You've some talkative friends, you do, Mr. Mallory."
"Did he now?" Mallory said, forcing a smile. "That file must make interesting reading. I'd surely like a look at it."
"I do suppose that intelligence might find its way to improper hands," the boy allowed.
"Of course, 'twould be worth a fellow's job if he were caught at it."
"Do you like your work, Mr. Tobias?"
"Pays not much. Gaslight ruins your eyes. But it has advantages."
He shrugged again and pushed his way through another door into a clattering anteroom, 3 of its walls lined with shelves and card files, the 4th with fretted glass. Behind the glass loomed a vast hall of towering engines, so many that at first Mallory thought the walls must surely be lined with mirrors, like a fancy ballroom. It was like some carnival deception meant to trick the eye, the giant identical engines, clock-like constructions of intricately interlocking brass, big as rail cars set on end, each on its foot-thick padded blocks. The whitewashed ceiling, 30 feet overhead, was alive with spinning pulley belts, the lesser gears drawing power from tremendous spoked flywheels on socketed iron columns. White-coated clackers, dwarfed by their machines, paced the spotless aisles. Their hair was swaddled in wrinkled white berets, their mouths and noses hidden behind squares of white gauze. Tobias glanced at these majestic racks of gearage with absolute indifference. All day staring at little holes. No mistakes, either. Hit a key punch wrong, and it's all the difference between a clergyman and an arsonist. Many's the poor innocent bastard ruined like that. The tick and sizzle of the monster clockwork muffled his words. 2 men, well-dressed and quiet, were engrossed in their work in the library. They bent together over a large square album of color plates.
"Pray have a seat," Tobias said.
Mallory seated himself at a library table, in a maple swivel chair mounted on rubber wheels, while Tobias selected a card file.
He sat opposite Mallory and leafed through the cards, pausing to dab a gloved finger in a small container of beeswax. He retrieved a pair of cards. "Were these your requests, sir?" "I filled out paper questionnaires, but you've put all that in engine for me." "Well, QC took the requests," Tobias said, squinting. "But we had to route it to criminal anthropometry. This card's seen use. They've done a deal of the sorting work already." He rose suddenly and fetched a loose-leaf notebook, a clacker's guide. He compared one of Mallory's cards to some ideal within the book, with a look of distracted disdain. "Did you fill the forms out completely, sir?"
"I think so," Mallory hedged.
"Height of suspect," the boy mumbled. "Reach. Length and width of left ear, left foot, left forearm, left forefinger." "I supplied my best estimates," Mallory said. "Why just the left side, if I may ask?" "That's affected by physical work," Tobias said absently. "Age, coloration of skin, hair, eyes, scars, birthmarks. Ah, now then, deformities." "The man had a bump on the side of his forehead," Mallory said. "Frontal plagiocephaly," the boy said, checking his book. "Rare, and that's why it struck me. But that should be useful. They're spoony on skulls in criminal anthropometry." Tobias plucked up the cards, dropped them through a slot, and pulled a bell rope. There was a sharp clanging. In a moment, a clacker arrived for the cards. "Now what?" Mallory said. "We wait for it to spin through," the boy said. "How long?" "It always takes twice as long as you think," the boy said, settling back in his chair. "Even if you double your estimate. Something of a natural law." Mallory nodded. The delay could not be helped and might be useful. "Have you worked here long, Mr. Tobias?" "Not long enough to go mad." Mallory chuckled. "You think I'm joking," Tobias said darkly. "Why do you work here if you hate it so?" "Everyone hates it who has a spark of sense," Tobias said. "Of course, it's fine work here if you work the top floors and are one of the big uns." He jabbed his gloved thumb discreetly at the ceiling. "Which I ain't, of course. But mostly the work needs little folk. They need us by the scores and dozens and hundreds. We come and go. 2 years of this work, maybe three, makes your eyes and your nerves go. You can go quite mad from staring at little holes, mad as a dancing dormouse." Tobias slid his hands into his apron pockets. "I'll wager you think, sir, from looking at us low clerks dressed like so many white pigeons, that we're all the same inside. But we ain't, sir, not at all. You see, there's only so many people in Britain who can read and write and spell and add as neat as they need here. Most co's who can do that, they'll get far better work if they've a mind to look. So the Bureau gets your, well, unsettled sorts." Tobias smiled thinly. "They've even hired women sometimes. Seamstresses, what lost their jobs to knitting jennies. Government hire 'em to read and punch cards. Very good at detail work, your former seamstresses." "It seems an odd policy," Mallory said. "Pressure of circumstance," Tobias said. "Nature of the business. You ever work for Her Majesty's government, Mr. Mallory?"
"In a way," Mallory said. He'd worked for the Royal Society's Commission on Free Trade. He'd believed their patriotic talk, their promises of backstage influence, and they'd cut him loose to fend for himself when they were through with him. A private audience with the Commission's Lord Galton, a warm handshake, an expression of deep regret that there could be no open recognition of his gallant service, and that was all, not so much as a signed scrap of paper.
"What kind of government work?" Tobias said.
"Ever seen the so-called Land Leviathan?"
"In the museum," Tobias said. "Brontosaurus, they call it. A reptile elephant. Had its teeth in the end of its trunk. The beast ate trees."
"Clever chap, Tobias."
"You're Leviathan Mallory," Tobias said. "The famous savant."
He flushed bright red. A bell rang. Tobias leapt to his feet. He took a pamphlet of accordioned paper from a tray in the wall.
"In luck, sir. Male suspect is done. I told you the skull business would help.
Tobias spread the paper on the table before Mallory. It was a collection of stipple-printed engine portraits, dark-haired Englishmen with hangdog looks. The little square picture bits of the engine prints were just big enough to distort their faces slightly, so that the men all seemed to have black drool in their mouths and dirt in the corners of their eyes. They all looked like brothers, some strange human subspecies of the devious and disenchanted. The portraits were nameless. They had citizen numbers beneath them. "I hadn't expected dozens of them," Mallory said. "We could have narrowed the choice with better parameters on the anthropometry," Tobias said. "But just take your time, sir, and look closely. If we have him, he's here." Mallory stared at the glowering ranks of numbered scapegraces, many of them with disquietingly misshapen heads. He remembered the tout's face with great clarity. He remembered it twisted with homicidal rage, bloody spittle in the cracked teeth. The sight was etched forever in his mind's eye, as vivid as the knuckle shapes of the beast's spine when first he'd seen his great prize jutting from the Wyoming shale. In one long dawning moment, then, Mallory had seen through those drab stone lumps and perceived the imminent glow of his own great glory, his coming fame. In just such a manner he had seen, in the tout's face, a lethal challenge that could transform his life. But none of these dazed and sullen portraits matched the memory. "Is there any reason why you wouldn't have this man?" "Perhaps your man has no criminal record," Tobias said. "We could run the card again to check against the general population, but that would take us weeks of engine spinning and require a special clearance from the people upstairs." "Why so long, pray?" "Dr. Mallory, we have everyone in Britain in our records. Everyone who's ever applied for work, or paid taxes, or been arrested." Tobias was apologetic, painfully eager to help. "Is he a foreigner, perhaps?" "I'm certain he was British, and a blackguard. He was armed and dangerous, but I simply don't see him here." "Perhaps it is a bad likeness, sir. Your criminal classes, they like to puff out their cheeks for criminal photography, wads of cotton up their noses and such like tricks. I'm sure he's there, sir." "I don't believe it. Is there another possibility?" Tobias sat down, defeated. "That's all we have, sir, unless you want to change your description." "Might someone have removed his portrait?" Tobias looked shocked. "That would be tampering with official files, sir. A felony transportation offense. I'm sure none of the clerks would have done such a thing." There was a heavy pause. "However," Mallory urged. "Well, the files are sacrosanct, sir. It is what we're all about here, as you know. But there are certain highly placed officials from outside the Bureau, men who serve the confidential safety of the realm, if you know the gents I mean." "I don't believe I do," Mallory said. "A very few gentlemen in positions of great trust and discretion," Tobias said. He glanced at the other men in the room and lowered his voice. "Perhaps you've heard of what they call the Special Cabinet, or the Special Bureau of the Bow Street Police?" "Anyone else?" Mallory said. "Well, the royal family, of course. We are servants of the Crown here, after all. If Albert himself were to command our Minister of Statistics, what about the Prime Minister, Lord Byron?" Tobias made no reply. His face had soured. "An idle question," Mallory said. "Forget I asked it. It's a scholar's habit, you see. When a topic interests me, I explore its specifics, even to the point of pedantry. But it has no relevance here." Mallory peered at the pictures again, with a show of close attention. "No doubt it is my own fault. The light here is not all it might be." "Let me turn up the gas," the boy said, half rising. "No," Mallory said. "Let me save my attention for the woman. Perhaps we'll have better luck there." Tobias sank back in his seat. As they awaited the engine spin, Mallory feigned a relaxed indifference. "Slow work, eh, Mr. Tobias? A lad of your intelligence must long for a greater challenge." "I do love engines," Tobias said. Not these great lummox monsters, but the cleverer aesthetic ones. I wanted to learn clacking.
Why aren't you in school, then?
Can't afford it, sir. The family doesn't approve.
Did you try the national merit exams?
No scholarship for me. I failed the calculus.
Tobias looked sullen.
I'm no scientist anyway. It's art that I live for. Kinotropy.
Theater work, eh? They say it's in the blood.
I spend every spare shilling on spinning time, the boy said. We have a little club of enthusiasts. The Palladium rents its kinotrope to us during the wee hours. You see quite amazing things sometimes, along with a deal of amateur drivel.
Fascinating, Mallory said. I hear that, he had to struggle to recall the man's name.
I hear that John Keats is quite good.
He's old, the boy said with a ruthless shrug. You should see Sands, or Hughes, or Etty.
And there's a clacker from Manchester whose work is quite splendid. Michael Radley. I saw a show of his here in London last winter. A lecture tour with an American.
Kinotrope lectures can be very improving.
Oh, the speaker was a crooked Yankee politician. If I had my way, they'd throw the speaker out entirely and run silent pictures.
Mallory let the conversation lapse. Tobias squirmed a bit, wanting to speak again and not quite daring to take that liberty. And then the bell rang. The boy was up like a shot with a scratchy skid of his worthless shoes and back with another set of fanfold paper.
Redheads, he said and smiled sheepishly.
Mallory grunted. He studied the women with close attention. They were fallen women, ruined women, with the sodden look of fall and ruin marked indelibly in the little black picture bits of their printed femininity. Unlike the men, the female faces somehow leapt to life for Mallory. Here a round-faced Cockney creature, with a look more savage than a Cheyenne squaw. There a sweet-eyed Irish girl whose lantern jaw had surely embittered her life. There a streetwalker with rat-nest hair and the blear of gin. There defiance, here tight-lipped insolence. There a frozen cajoling look from an Englishwoman with her nape pinched for too long in the daguerreotype's neck brace. The eyes, with their calculated plea of injured innocence, held him with a shock of recognition. Mallory tapped the paper, looking up.
Here she is!
Tobias started.
That's rum, sir. Let me take that number.
He punched the citizen number into a fresh card with a small mahogany switch press, then fed the card through the wall tray again. He carefully emptied the bits of punched-out paper into a hinge-topped basket.
This will tell me all about her, will it? Mallory said.
He reached inside his jacket for his notebook.
Mostly, sir. A printed summary.
And may I take these documents away with me for study?
No, sir. Strictly speaking, as you're not an officer of the law.
Tobias lowered his voice.
Truth to tell, sir, you could pay a common magistrate, or even his clerk, and have this intelligence for a few shillings under the rose. Once you've someone's number, the rest is simple enough. It's a common clacker trick, to read the engine files on someone of the criminal class. They call it pulling his string, or being up on a cake.
Mallory found this news of remarkable interest.
Suppose I asked for my own file, he said.
Well, sir, you're a gentleman, not a criminal. You're not in the common police files. Your magistrates and court clerks and such would have to fill out forms and show good cause for the search, which we don't grant easily.
Legal protocols, eh? Mallory said.
No, sir, it's no law that stops us, but the simple trouble of it. Such a search consumes engine time and money, and we're always over budget in both. But if an MP made that request, or a lordship...
Suppose I had a good friend here in the Bureau, Mallory said. Someone who admired me for my generous ways.
Tobias looked reluctant and a bit coy.
It ain't a simple matter, sir. Every spinning run is registered, and each request must have a sponsor. What we did today is done in Mr. Wakefield's name, so there'll be no trouble in that. But your friend would have to forge some sponsor's name and run the risk of that imposture. It is fraud, sir. An engine fraud, like credit theft or stock fraud, and punished just the same when it's found out.
Very enlightening, Mallory said.
I found that one always profits by talking to a technical man who truly knows his business. Let me give you my card. Mallory extracted one of his Maul and Polyblank carte de visite from his pocketbook. Folding a 5-pound note, he pinched it against the back of his card and passed it over. It was a handsome sum, a deliberate investment. Tobias dug about beneath his apron, found a greasy leather wallet, stuffed in Mallory's card and money, and extracted a dog-eared bit of shiny pasteboard. J.J. Tobias, Esquire, the card said, in grotesquely elaborate engine Gothic. Kinotropy and theater collectibles. There was a Whitechapel address. Never mind that telegraph number at the bottom, Tobias told him. I had to stop renting it. Have you any interest in French kinotropy, Mr. Tobias? Mallory said. Oh, yes, sir, nodded Tobias. Some lovely material is coming out of Montmartre these days. I understand the best French ordinateur employ a special gauge of card. The Napoleon gauge, Tobias said readily. Smaller cards of an artificial substance which move very swiftly in the compilers. That speed is quite handy in kino work. Do you know where a fellow might rent one of these French compilers here in London? To translate data from French cards, sir? Yes, Mallory said, feigning an only casual interest. I expect to receive some data from a French colleague involving a scientific controversy. Rather abstruse, but still a matter of some scholarly confidentiality. I prefer to examine it privately at my own convenience. Yes, sir, Tobias said. That is to say, I do know a fellow with a French compiler, and he'd let you do whatever you like with it if the pay were right. Last year there was quite a mode in London clacking circles for the French standard. But sentiment has turned quite against it, what with the troubles of the Grand Napoleon. Really? Mallory said. Tobias nodded, delighted to show his authority. I believe it's felt now, sir, that the French were far ahead of themselves with their vast Napoleon project, and made something of a technical misstep. Mallory stroked his beard. That wouldn't be British professional envy talking, I hope. Not at all, sir. It's common knowledge that the Grand Napoleon suffered some dire mishap early this year, Tobias assured him, and the great engine has never spun quite properly since. He lowered his voice. Some claim sabotage. Do you know that French term, sabotage? Comes from sabot, the wooden shoes worn by French workers. They can kick an engine half off its blocks. Tobias grinned at this prospect with a glee that rather disquieted Mallory. The French have Luddite troubles of a sort, you see, sir, much as we once did, years ago. Two short notes were sounded on a steam whistle, reverberating through the whitewashed ceiling. The two studious gentlemen, who had been joined by an equally studious third, now closed their albums and left. The bell rang once more, summoning Tobias to the wall tray. The boy rose slowly, straightened a chair, wandered down the length of the table, examined the albums for non-existent dust, and shelved them. I think that's our answer waiting, Mallory said. Tobias nodded shortly, his back to Mallory. Very likely, sir. But I'm on overtime, see? Those two blasts on the horn. Mallory rose impatiently and strode to the tray. No, no, Tobias yelped. Not without gloves. Pray let me do it. Gloves, indeed. Who's to know? Criminal anthropometry, that's who. This is their room, and nothing they hate worse than the smudges from bare fingers. Tobias turned with a sheaf of documents. Well, sir, our suspect is one Florence Bartlett, nay Russell, late of Liverpool. Thank you, Tobias, Mallory said, creasing the sheaf of fan folds so as to slip it more easily into his Ada checkered waistcoat. I do appreciate your help. One Arctic Wyoming morning, the frost thick on the brown and beaten prairie grass, Mallory had crouched beside the tepid boiler of the expedition's steam fortress, prodding at its meager buffalo dung fire, trying to thaw an iron-hard strip of the jerked beef that the men ate for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. At that moment of utter misery, his beard rimed with frozen breath and his shovel-blistered fingers frostbitten, Mallory had sworn a solemn oath that he would never again curse the summer heat. but never had he expected so vile a swelter in London. The night had passed without a breath of wind, and his bed had seemed a fetid stew. He'd slept atop the sheets, a drenched Turkish towel spread across his nakedness, and had risen every hour to dampen the towel again. Now the mattress was soaked, and the whole room seemed as hot and close as a greenhouse. It stank of stale tobacco as well, for Mallory had smoked half a dozen of his fine Havanas over the criminal record of Florence Russell Bartlett, which dealt primarily with the murder of her husband, a prominent Liverpool cotton merchant, in the spring of 1853. The modus operandi had been poisoning by arsenic, which Mrs. Bartlett had extracted from flypaper and administered over a period of weeks in a patent medicine, Dr. Gove's Hydropathic Strengthener. Mallory, from his nights down Haymarket, knew that Dr. Gove's was in fact a patent aphrodisiac, but the file made no mention of this fact. The fatal illness in 1852 of Bartlett's mother and of her husband's brother in 1851 were also recorded, their respective certificates of death citing perforated ulcer and cholera morbus. These purported illnesses featured symptoms very like those of arsenic poisoning. Never formally accused of these other deaths, Mrs. Bartlett had escaped custody, overpowering her jailer with a concealed derringer. The Central Statistics Bureau suspected her of having fled to France, Mallory assumed, because someone had appended translations of French police reports of 1854 dealing with a crime passionnel trial in the Paris Assizes. One Florence Murphy, abortionist, purportedly an American refugee, was arrested and tried for the crime of vitriolage, the flinging of sulfuric acid with intent to disfigure or maim. The victim, Marie Lemoine, wife of a prominent Lyon silk merchant, was an apparent rival. But Mrs. Murphy had vanished from custody and from all subsequent French police records during the first week of her trial as a vitrioleuse. Mallory sponged his face, neck, and armpits in tap water, thinking bleakly of vitriol. He was perspiring freely again as he laced his shoes. Leaving his room, he discovered that the city's queer summer had overwhelmed the palace. Sullen humidity simmered over the marble floors like an invisible swamp. The very palms at the foot of the stairs seemed Jurassic. He trudged to the palace's dining room, where four cold, hard-boiled eggs, iced coffee, a kippered herring, some broiled tomato, a bit of ham, and a chilled melon somewhat restored him. The food here was rather good, though the kipper had smelled a bit off. Small wonder in heat like this. Mallory signed the chit and left to fetch his mail. He had been unjust to the kipper. Outside the dining room, the palace itself stank. Bad fish or something much like it. There was a soapy perfume in the front lobby, left from the morning's mopping, but the air was heavy with the humid distant reek of something dreadful, and apparently long dead. Mallory knew he had smelled that reek before. It was sharp, like acid, mixed with the greasy stench of a slaughterhouse, but he could not place the memory. In a moment the stink was gone again. He stepped to the desk for his mail. The wilted clerk greeted him with a show of courtesy. Mallory had won the staff's loyalty with generous tips. "Nothing in my box," said Mallory, surprised. "Too small, Dr. Mallory." The clerk bent to lift a large woven wire basket, crammed to the brim with envelopes, magazines, and packages. "'Struth," Mallory said. "It gets worse every day." The clerk nodded knowingly. "The price of fame, sir." Mallory was overwhelmed. "I suppose I shall have to read through all of this." "If I may be so bold, sir, I think you might do well to engage a private secretary." Mallory grunted. He had a loathing of secretaries, valets, butlers, chambermaids, the whole squalid business of service. His own mother had been in service once, with a wealthy family in Sussex, in the old days before the Rads. The fact rankled. He carried the heavy basket into a quiet corner of the library and began to sort through it. Magazines first, the gold-spined Transactions of the Royal Society, Herpetology of All Nations, Journal of Dynamical Systematics, Annales Scientifiques de l'École des Ordinateurs, with what seemed to be an interesting article on the mechanical miseries of the Grand Napoleon. This business of the scholarly subscriptions had been a faggot above a load, though he supposed it kept the editors happy, happy editors being half the key to placing one's own articles. Then the letters. Swiftly, Mallory divided them into piles, begging letters first. He had made the mistake of answering a few that had seemed especially tearful and sincere, and now the scheming rascals had swarmed upon him like lice. A second pile of business letters, invitations to speak, requests for interviews, bills from shopmen, catastrophist bone men and rockhounds offering co-authorship of learned papers. Then the letters in feminine hand, the broody hens of natural history, flower snippers, Huxley called them. They wrote in their scores and dozens, most merely to request his autograph, and, if he so pleased, a signed carte de visite. Others would send him coy sketches of common lizards, requesting his expertise in reptile taxonomy. Others would express a delicate admiration, perhaps accompanied with verses, and invite him to tea if he was ever in Sheffield or Nottingham or Brighton. And some few, often marked by spiky handwriting, triple underlining, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, and ribboned locks of hair, would express a warm, womanly admiration, and this in terms so bold as to be quite disconcerting. There had been a remarkable flurry of these after his fancy portrait had appeared in the Englishwoman's Domestic Weekly. Mallory stopped suddenly. He had almost flung aside a letter from his sister Ruth. Dear little Ruthie. But of course, the baby of the family was a good 17 years old now. He opened the letter at once. Dear Ned, I write to you at Mother's dictation, as her hands are quite bad today. Father thanks you very much for the splendid lap rug from London. The French liniment has helped my hand, Mother's, very nicely, though more in the knees than the hands. We all miss you much in Lewis, though we know you are busy on your great affairs of the Royal Society. We read aloud each of your American adventures as they are written by Mr. Disraeli in Family Museum. Agatha asks, will you please, please get her Mr. Disraeli's autograph, as her favorite novel is his Tancred. But our great news is that our dear Brian is back from Bombay, safely with us this very day, June 17th, and he has brought with him our dear brother-to-be, Lieutenant Jerry Rawlings, also of the Sussex Artillery, who asked our Madeline to wait for him, and of course she did. Now they are to be married, and Mother wants you to know particularly that it will not be in a church, but a civil ceremony with the J.P., Mr. Witherspoon, in Lewis City Hall. Will you attend June 29th, as Father gives away almost his last bride? I did not want to write that, but Mother made me. All our love, Ruth Mallory, Miss.
So, little Madeline, with her man at last. Poor creature. 4 years was a long engagement, more worrisome still when betrothed to a soldier in a tropical pest hole like India. She had taken his ring at 18, and was now all of 22. A long engagement was a cruel thing to ask of a young and lively girl, and Mallory had seen in his last visit that the ordeal had sharpened Madeline's tongue and temper, and made her almost a trial to the household. Soon there would be no one left at home to look after the old folks but little Ruthie. And when Ruth married, well, he would consider that matter in due time. Mallory rubbed his sweating beard. Madeline had had life harder than Ernestina, or Agatha, or Dorothy. She should have something fine for herself, Mallory resolved. A wedding gift that would prove that she had put an end to her unhappy time. Mallory took the letter basket to his room, piled the mail on the floor beside his overflowing bureau, and left the palace, dropping the basket at the desk on his way out. A group of Quakers, men and women, stood on the pavement outside the palace. They were droning another of their intolerable sermonizing ditties, something about a railway to heaven by the sound of it. The song did not seem to have much to do with evolution, or blasphemy, or fossils, but perhaps the sheer monotony of their bootless protests had exhausted even the Quakers. He hurried past them, ignoring their proffered pamphlets. It was hot, uncommon hot, beastly hot.
There was not a ray of sun, but the air was mortally still, and the high cloudy sky had a leaden, glowering look, as if it wanted to rain, but had forgotten the trick of it. Mallory walked down Gloucester Road to the corner of Cromwell. There was a fine new equestrian statue of Cromwell at the intersection. Cromwell was a great favorite of the Rads. And there were buses, too, 6 an hour, but they were all crammed to the gunwales. No one wanted to walk in weather like this. Mallory tried the Gloucester Road Underground by the corner of Ashburn Mews. As he prepared to descend the stairs, a thin crowd came up at a half-run, fleeing a reek of such virulence that it stopped him in his tracks. Londoners were used to odd smells from their undergrounds, but this stench was clearly of another order entirely. Compared to the sullen heat of the streets, the air was chill, but it had a deathly scent, like something gone rotten in a sealed glass jar. Mallory went to the ticket office. It was closed, with a sign up saying, "We apologize for the inconvenience." No mention of the actual nature of the problem. Mallory turned. There were horse-drawn cabs at Bailey's Hotel, across Courtfield Road. He prepared to cross the street, but then noticed a cab waiting quite near him at the curb, apparently idle. Signaling the driver, he went to the door. There was a passenger still inside the cab. Mallory waited politely for the man to debark. Instead, the stranger, seeming to resent Mallory's gaze, pressed a kerchief to his face and half sunk below the level of the window. He began coughing. Perhaps the man was ill, or had just come up from the underground and not yet caught his breath. Annoyed, Mallory crossed the street and engaged a cab at Bailey's. "Piccadilly," he ordered. The driver clicked to his sweating nag, and they rolled east up Cromwell Road. Once underway, with a faint breeze at the window, the heat became less oppressive, and Mallory's spirits rose. Cromwell Road, Thurlow Place, Brompton Road, in their vast rebuilding schemes, the government had reserved these sections of Kensington and Brompton to a vast concourse of museums and Royal Society palaces. One by one they passed his window in their sober majesty of cupolas and colonnades, physics, economics, chemistry. One might complain of some radical innovations, Mallory mused, but there was no denying the sense and justice of fine headquarters for scholars engaged in the noblest work of mankind. Surely, in their aid to science, the palaces had repaid the lavish cost of their construction at least a dozen times. Up Knightsbridge and past Hyde Park Corner to the Napoleon Arch, a gift from Louis Napoleon to commemorate the Anglo-French Entente. The great iron arch, with its lavish skeleton of struts and bolting, supported a large population of winged cupids and draperied ladies with torches. A handsome monument, Mallory thought, and in the latest taste. Its elegant solidity seemed to deny that there had ever been a trace of discord between Great Britain and her staunchest ally, Imperial France. Perhaps, thought Mallory wryly, the misunderstandings of the Napoleonic Wars could be blamed on the tyrant Wellington. Though London possessed no monuments to the Duke of Wellington, it sometimes seemed to Mallory that unspoken memories of the man still haunted the city, an unlaid ghost. Once the great victor of Waterloo had been exalted here as the very savior of the British nation. Wellington had been ennobled and had held the highest office in the land. But in modern England he was vilified as a swaggering brute, a second King John, the butcher of his own restless people. The Rads had never forgotten their hatred for their early and formidable enemy. A full generation had passed since Wellington's death, but Prime Minister Byron still often spattered the Duke's memory with the acid of his formidable eloquence. Mallory, though a loyal Radical Party man, was unconvinced by mere rhetorical abuse. He privately entertained his own opinion of the long-dead tyrant. On his first trip to London at the age of 6, Mallory had once seen the Duke of Wellington, passing in his gilded carriage in the street with a clopping, jingling escort of armed cavalry. And the boy Mallory had been vastly impressed, not simply by that famous hook-nosed face, high-collared and whiskered, groomed and stern and silent, but by his own father's awe-struck mix of fear and pleasure at the Duke's passage. some faint tang of that childhood visit to London, in 1831, the first year of the Time of Troubles, the last of England's old regime, still clung to Mallory whenever he saw the capital. Some few months later, in Lewis, his father had cheered wildly when news came of Wellington's death in a bomb atrocity. But Mallory had secretly wept, stirred to bitter sorrow for a reason he could not now recall. His seasoned judgment saw the Duke of Wellington as the outmoded, ignorant victim of an upheaval beyond his comprehension, more Charles I than King John. Wellington had foolishly championed the interests of declining and decadent Tory bluebloods, a class destined to be swept from power by the rising middle class and the savant meritocrats. But Wellington himself had been no blueblood. He had once been plain Arthur Wellesley, of rather modest Irish origin. Further, it seemed to Mallory that as a soldier, Wellington had displayed a very praiseworthy mastery of his craft. It was only as a civil politician and a reactionary prime minister that Wellington had so thoroughly misjudged the revolutionary tenor of the coming age of industry and science. He had paid for that lack of vision with his honor, his power, and his very life. And the England that Wellington had known and misruled, the England of Mallory's childhood, had slid through strikes, manifestos, and demonstrations to riots, martial law, massacres, open class warfare, and near total anarchy. Only the Industrial Radical Party, with their boldly rational vision of a comprehensive new order, had saved England from the abyss. But even so, Mallory thought, even so, there should be a monument somewhere. The cabriolet rolled up Piccadilly, passing Down Street, Whitehorse Street, Half Moon Street. Mallory thumbed through his address book and found Lawrence Oliphant's carte de visite. Oliphant lived on Half Moon Street. Mallory had half a mind to stop the cab and see if Oliphant were at home. If, unlike most posh courtiers, Oliphant perhaps rose before 10, he might have something like a bucket of ice in his household and perhaps a drop of something to open the pores. The thought of boldly interrupting Oliphant's day and perhaps surprising him at some covert intrigue was a pleasant one to Mallory. But first things first, perhaps he would try Oliphant when his errand was done. Mallory stopped the cab at the entrance to the Burlington Arcade. The gigantic iron-framed ziggurat of Fortnum and Mason lurked across the street, amid an array of jewelers and exclusive shops. The cabbie severely overcharged him, but Mallory took no notice, being in an expansive mood. It seemed the cabbies were imposing on everyone. Some small distance down Piccadilly, a leper man had leapt from his cab and was arguing in a vulgar fashion with his driver. Mallory had found nothing to equal shopping in its gratifying demonstration of the power of his newfound wealth. He had won his money through an act of half-mad bravado, but the secret of its origin was safe with him. London's credit machines clicked for the vaporous profits of gambling as readily as they did for the widow's mite. End of Side 4. Change Side Selector Switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.